I went down this rabbit hole a couple months ago looking up canines, and I came across your Instagram.
And there's a big misconception that the dogs always find something. Dogs are trained to the odor of a substance, not necessarily the substance. We've never had a dog ever in the world follow somebody, prevent a terrorist incident from occurring.
Oh.
What we use the dogs to do is the deterrent value.
Are you training mostly for police and military? Like, who are the other people that would need dogs like this? What are some of the most challenging cases or scenarios you've encountered while training or working with these dogs?
To be able to get a dog to go from a boat in the ocean, go through the surf passage, clear the beach, and then go potentially another 8 kilometers.
How do you address the well-being or stress levels of the dog when they're in training and actually when they're on an operation? What trends or innovations do you believe will define the next decade of canine training?
Dogs aren't perfect, and we already know the handlers aren't perfect. We're not looking for certainty, we're looking for probability.
Welcome back, everybody, to Misunderstood. Today, I am joined by one of the foremost experts in canine training and scent detection, Cameron Ford. With more than 20 years of experience, Cameron has revolutionized the way we understand and utilize canines in security and law enforcement. In light of heightened concerns around safety and security, especially following the tragic murder of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson, Cameron's insights are more critical than ever. We'll discuss the often misunderstood science behind scent detection, the vital role canines play in keeping us safe, and how we can better harness their incredible capabilities in a world that increasingly demands heightened vigilance. Please join me in welcoming the brilliant Cameron Ford. Cameron, thank you so much for joining me today on Misunderstood. I'm so excited to have you here. I went down this rabbit hole a couple months ago looking up canines and what they're used for. I was at a vet's office with my own dog, and I saw a whole police department come in bringing their dogs. And I found it fascinating because they're so much different than the dogs that us civilians have. And I came across your Instagram and found you really interesting because you really talk about scent detection and had a different path than most people that are doing this kind of thing with canines. So I want to hear all about that. But before we start, I wanted to get into your background a little bit. What inspired you to get into the line of work that you're in? Tell us a little bit about how your journey began.
Sure. So for me, as a little kid, I grew up in Florida, and my neighbor was the guy who kind of started police canines in the state. And this is like back in the early 70s, 80s. And that ended up having a profound effect on me. First, I was scared to death of all the police dogs and security dogs he had at his property. Then it turned into I loved them. That just being around that brought me into, as I got older, ended up working with law enforcement at his facility, being the tackle dummy for the dogs, being the decoy, as they call it. Then I got into the military in the mid 90s, and I was in the Air Force, and that really kind of put me in a trajectory to get into where I am now, which was the place of all places they stuck me when I was in the Air Force was in Germany, where kind of the motherland of police dogs kind of comes from in a lot of ways, at least back in those days. And being there and being in Europe, I traveled to different countries, learned the different programs that each country had. Each one has a unique kind of either sport program or the way they do police dogs or military dogs. So those years there kind of made it very formative for me and put me in a great position to learn and kind of get my passion really ignited. And after my time in Europe, I then came back to Florida and did my business, which I was importing the dogs from Europe to put them with police agencies throughout United States, basically. I mean, even though it still blows my mind now that, you know, I was some 28-year-old, you know, kid in a way, fresh out of military, training guys my age how to do their police dogs, or basically how to train their dogs, not really how to deploy them, but how to train them. And that kind of grew until it was during the housing boom in Florida. Then I sold the property. I had 10 acres in Sanford, Florida, and I ended up selling it to a developer, and then went to being a cop and worked as a police officer in Central Florida. And then during that time, of course, was the height of the Iraq and Afghanistan war. I kind of got lured back into the military / contracting world. And then I went out to Texas. And while I was in Texas, I worked as a military contractor, getting dogs and handlers ready to go to either Afghanistan or Iraq, depending on the contract needs. And that was where it became more focused on detection, because of what we had to deal with in those countries and in wartime, mitigating the threat of explosives and making sure, you know, deployments could occur as safe as possible. So that was kind of the beginning of it. And when I was over there, just being exposed to is actually somebody I dated. She worked for SeaWorld, and she kind of steered me even further into what I would call the science side of things. And in that time with, you know, in the contracting world, you live or die by your military contracts, basically. So at a certain period of time, the contracts kind of started drying up as the war started drawing down. And a friend of mine had a contract with the U.S. Navy SEALs. So in short, he reached out to me, or actually I ran into him at a conference, and we were speaking, and he was like, "Hey, I might need you in the near future." So sure enough, a few months later, he hit me up, and then that brought me to Coronado, where I became the senior instructor later on for what we call Naval Special Warfare Group 1, which is your SEAL teams 1, 3, 5, and 7. And out there, my job was to get dogs ready for SEAL team operators. And at the same time, I've been doing it at that point about 20 years in the dog business and being a handler, trainer, et cetera. And I was confident in my skills. But then when you're in a room with what we call the head shed, which is basically all your SEAL team command staff wanting to know, can the dog team do X, Y, or Z? You start to question whether or not you can actually make that happen. So that forced me to get into the science world, to really understand, what does odor do? What is a dog's capabilities? And that was where I would say it was kind of the perfect storm of where science and my experience and mission requirements all kind of came together. And that kind of formed where I am today and what I do and the information I share with a lot of people when it comes to the dog world.
Wow, that is so fascinating. So take me back for a second. I'm curious how you, I mean, I know you have so much experience, but how do you train these kind of dogs? Like, what is the education? How is there must be some psychology of dogs that goes into it, behavioral things. Can you explain all that?
Yeah, so it's the dog world's pretty unique in the sense that there's no kind of regulatory board. There's no one that says it has to be done this way or that way. And that's good and it's bad. Depends on what you're doing, right? So with that, how we train can kind of fall under what kind of preference a trainer may have. Most are going to follow either a system that they learned, or they may follow what psychology or science says we do. And at the end of the day, it always falls back to psychology in some realm or another. How much that trainer uses to their advantage depends on the trainer. The real short version of it is you're basically associating reinforcement, so their toy or their reward item, to when they find odor. So some cases, trainers will take the reward item and put it next to the odor or with the odor, and then eventually phase out that reward item. Other trainers will have the odor there by itself, and when the dog comes into that odor, then they reward them. Both methodologies work, and it also depends a little bit on the dog. There's a lot of things relative to the dog in front of you that dictates what you do. And then, of course, the lovely side of it, which is the human, which also throws a bunch of curveballs into it. But in a nutshell, it's basically you're taking odor and you're associating it with reward. And After a certain period of time, you start adding more and more requirements. It could be searching longer, more odors, how odors are shown to the dog, how they're concealed. And it just starts going down various different, I would call it rabbit holes of like how crazy it can get depending on the type of job that the dog's teams actually have when they go out and deploy.
Right. So let me ask you a question. Does a dog have to be trained for a specific odor, or can it be human detection? Can it also be a bomb sniffing dog? I mean, when you train these dogs, you have to pick one specialty.
When it comes to detection, yes, you're going to pick one odor discipline. So whether it be, let's say, like in the military world, it's going to be mostly focused on explosives. Okay. And in the explosive realm, there's an average, you'll hear different groups say they train up to 10 to 13 main core odors, as we call it. So the dog will have to remember those, let's just call it 13 odors on average. But within that is a lot of combinations, because it's not just sometimes one single chemical. It could be a combination of chemicals together that make up an explosive device. So you then have to expose the dog to those different types of chemicals altogether. So we can't just make an assumption like we kind of used to that, oh, if it's trained on this chemical in the way that I have it, it'll automatically find it in every kind of combination. And that turned out to be not true. In the narcotics world, it's slightly different there. They have less odors to train on. And then now with the increase of firearm regulation, or wanting to make sure certain places are safe from firearms, you now have the firearm detection dog. I was lucky enough to do research with Texas Tech University with a lady named Dr. Paula Tiedemann. And we looked at what is a dog detecting when it comes to firearms. And there was a lot of beliefs that existed for a long time, which was, oh, you train him on the powder, you train him on the oils, you train him on the, you know, all these different things. Turns out what they're really paying attention to is the gunshot residue, because the minute the gun is fired, those powders are burned and they smell completely different than the powder by itself. Right. So that kind of information was super helpful, because now what I spend a lot of time doing is traveling with the agencies, teaching them, hey, when we're teaching a dog a firearm, the most important or relevant odor, let's say, is the gunshot residue. So for that dog, it's typically one main odor with some other things that are in the background that are not as relevant.
Right.
So in detection, this is why you don't want to cross disciplines. You don't want to make a bomb dog, a drug dog, and so forth, because then there's a whole procedure we call action on find. What do you do when the dog does alert? And if your dog was trained in both, let's say explosives and narcotics, do you call the bomb squad or do you execute a search warrant? You know, there's all these different things that go into play.
But that's what I was going to ask, because don't you have to train dogs for certain ways that they react? Because if there's a guy walking around with a bomb and the dog goes in front of him and sits down, the guy can just pull the pin and kill everybody. I'm making this up, but yeah. Or you have a dog that does something to alert you in a different way. I mean, I'm assuming there's different ways that you react based on what they're looking for, right?
Correct. So a lot of, let's say, teams that are out there right now, there's a lot of different terms that are used to basically mean the same thing. The dog is searching a pedestrian environment. And if somebody has, let's say, explosive or firearms on them, the dog will start following that individual. The handler is supposed to be able to read that information. And in, I would say, an operational aspect, we're not waiting for a full blown indication like you described. Okay. What we're looking for is, can the handler say, my dog is pursuing this odor and it's going this direction, it's probably this person. And that's where we call it security in depth, where there's lots of layers of security. So the dog does this information, or cameras are watching and the camera teams by radio let somebody else know in the security team, hey, the dog followed this individual. There's a lot of different ways, depending on the threat and depending on how things are done, how it's handled. But you're correct. You're not looking for, in a operational setting, the dog to pursue the person per se, because of the potential risk, like you talked about. If I have bad intentions and I know I'm about ready to get caught, what do I got to lose at that point? I'm just going to take out what I can take out. So we call it clack off. I just set off the explosive device that's on me or whatever.
Right.
Now, in reality, we've never had a dog ever in the world follow somebody, prevent a terrorist incident from occurring by what we just described.
Oh.
What we use the dogs to do is the deterrent value, making sure that that somebody says, you know what, I don't like this target because there's too much security here. Mm. And there's the other psychological aspect that comes with it, which is the people attending these events feel safer because they see the dogs there. So there's a little bit of what I call the reality check. Dogs are amazing things, but they're not the final and only layer. They're part of a much broader security measure to keep things safe.
Right. So the training, obviously, as you said before, is not just for the dogs, but it's for the handlers. And they have to seem to have an extraordinary relationship with that animal and be able to read them. The dog has to be able to read, I guess, read the human as well, correct?
Absolutely. One of the things that I think gets not enough attention is the human side of the equation.
Yeah.
One of the biggest things I run into when I'm around teaching is basically helping handlers do the one most important job that they have, which is to read their dog. You're an interpreter of a canine, and you do need to know your dog really well and to know sometimes a subtle change just because the odor or the environment or whatever's happening is not perfect like it is in training. Mm. And to be really good as a handler means you need to really know your dog. Mm. And to catch sometimes a subtle change that you know is predictable, repeatable, reliable to the dog telling you there's something there. Now, is it ever perfect? No, it's never going to be perfect. There's no perfect human. There's no perfect dog. But your goal is to be as proficient and fluent as possible right. in this work. So that way you can provide relevant information to mitigate any potential risk or threat.
So I have a question. Do you have to train these kind of dogs from birth because that is their purpose? Or can you get a dog out of the local shelter and give it a purpose and train this dog? And can it be any breed? I mean, we obviously all always see two or three specific breeds, but you tell me.
Yeah. So there's so the answer is all of it. So there's plenty of dogs that get rescued from shelters that are basically how they got in the shelters because they had too much energy, too much motivation, too much drive. Mm-hmm. But when you give them a job like this, they do really well. The hardest part about the shelter aspect in most cases is the dog environmental. And what we mean by that is the dog's ability to handle a loud environment or to be at a, like being in Vegas, searching a concert where you have huge speakers and fireworks and all these kinds of things that are going on and mm-hmm. still want to go work. So that's where the genetic side, the breeding side of it comes into play. So like you said, it's not necessarily raised from birth to do detection. There are various breeders and vendors who do focus on that. But what we, as your end user, typically gets the dog right around a year old, let's just say 10 months to a year and a half. Yeah. That's when the handler or the trainer who's going to provide the dog gets the dog and then begins formalized training in detection or any type of security or law enforcement work. So that's, and then when it comes to the breeds are, can be older, can be mixed breeds. But like you said, your most popular breeds are going to be your Belgian Malinois. These are the, I'll call the pointy ear dogs first. Your Belgian Malinois, your German Shepherd, your Dutch Shepherd. But in detection, we can also use Labradors, Pointers, and Spaniels are probably your top three there. And then any mixtures thereof. And there's other breeds that you'll see in there too. I've seen like in Australia, they have lots of Border Collies or Kelpies. Right. You go to other countries, they have other breeds as well. So it's not necessarily regulated to the paint job, to the breed of the dog. It right. comes down to their motivation and their environmental soundness to do the job.
And did that start with those breeds because genetically they are smarter, or is it because they looked scarier? I mean, how did that start?
There's a good friend of mine, a guy named Craig Koshik, who I've had on my show a couple times, talks about the history, like how did we get there? And in the 1800s, a shepherd type dog became the first police dog. And it would look like a mutt to us today, but it would be what we would call like the first style of German Shepherd. Okay. And it was because it was highly collaborative with the human. It had herding instincts. It was willing to bite and hold and play vigorously, things of that nature. So right. that was kind of how it started. And then because it that kind of look or breed became a police dog, then those that wanted to do that type of work follow the same type of breed. Mm-hmm. And then as time goes by, people realized, oh, there's other breeds that can do this quite well, you know. And we started looking at genetics, like you said. So shepherds, whether it be Belgian Malinois, German Shepherd, Dutch Shepherd, are herding breeds. So they're visual first, but they do put their mouth on things. They play a lot. But then the sporting breeds, like your Spaniels, your Labs, and your Pointers, those breeds use their noses quite well. So the detection world really embraced what we call the floppy ear breeds, because they're genetically designed to use their nose and they love to hunt. So both breed categories can do the jobs. The floppy ear breeds are your specialty detection dogs. Your pointy ear breeds are the ones that do detection and probably some type of what we call patrol work, where they do the bite work or the tracking and things like that.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Right. And are there certain qualities, like if you're picking this dog at 10 months old or out of a shelter, that you are looking for that you're like, oh, I can actually train this dog, or qualities you would stay away from?
Yeah. So number one is going to be the environmental soundness. I want to make sure that this dog can handle whatever the world throws at it. And the world and Mother Nature is a tough place. Okay. And what we deal with in these operational environments, it can't be accounted for. So when I'm testing dogs, we're looking for, are they sound environmentally? Like loud noises don't bother them.
Meaning they're not hiding in the bathroom or in the corner.
Correct. They can handle slick floors, ride on escalators, ride on elevators.
Yeah.
All these different things that they're going to have to go do, they can do that and it doesn't degrade their performance. So that's the first piece I look for, is are they environmentally sound? Okay. And in that same realm, I'm also looking for one who's not overly animal oriented, meaning they're not seeking out places to go mark or to pay attention to other dogs in the environment or other animals. We call it crittering. I don't want a dog who's out there crittering and looking for or being distracted by other animals in the environment. Then once I know that part, because pretty much if you ask most trainers reasons why its dogs wash out, most times it's going to be, number one is going to be environmental issues. Then once I know the dog is environmentally sound, then I start looking at, okay, how well does it basically hunt or search? How well does it play? You know, those two things kind of go hand in hand most times. If a dog plays well, they'll generally search well. It's not always the case, but this is why testing occurs. And we test how well they hunt, how long they hunt for, and while they're hunting, if this or that happens, how much do they want to collaborate with the human? I want a dog who wants to play with me, not just take the toy and run away from me. So a dog who's very collaborative with me is going to be a dog that makes my life easier as a handler to work with. And because of we're a team together, I need that quality. So I'm looking for the dog who's not aloof, who's ignoring the human contact, or just looks at you as a toy dispenser. I want that dog who's wants to engage with me and play and have fun and do these things. And that's how you quantify that. It's kind of like one of those things, you know, when you see it, you know, the right balance of a dog who is engaged with you. Because the flip side of that is, if I have a dog who's too engaged in the human, that becomes a distraction too, because then all they want to do.
I would think there is probably a misconception that a lot of these dogs you see, and again, us civilians, we see these dogs when we're at schools, when we're walking through the airport, at events sometimes, but the dogs seem like dogs that are not, you can't pet them. They don't seem like they're snuggling at home in your bed, like all mine do, you know, like, but from what I've heard from some other people on my show, these are dogs that are highly loved and lovable, but not while they're at work.
So basically correct. So while they're at work, I want them in work mode.
Right.
It doesn't mean that they can't have some type of interaction, but that interaction does have to be controlled.
Right.
But like you said, there is the old mentality, which was, hey, if you're not working that dog, you keep it in a crate, you keep it in a cage, you deprive it from your life because it has to work for you. We kind of know now that that's in most cases not necessarily true. Mm. What we want is a dog who, and if you ask any military member, when was your best relationship with your dog? Every single one of them will tell you is when I was deployed with my dog. And when they were deployed with their dog, meant they were sleeping next to each other, they were in the tent, or they're in the buildings together, as opposed to when it's normal military time where the dogs are kenneled on base and the handler lives where they live. So right then and there, you can already see that the relationship does require basically some type of cohabitation with each other. You do need to live with each other. You do need to be around each other. Now, can you control it? Absolutely. If I'm busy doing stuff, then yes, my dog can go in its crate or its kennel or whatever for those short periods of time while I'm doing stuff. But the old mentality of, oh, you have to be, if you're not working the dog, you separate from the dog. And sadly, that's still pretty prominent mentality. And the reason behind that mentality is that people would say, well, if you're around the dog too much, or you make the dog, if the dog lives with you, it's going to turn into a house pet. Now, right. Of course, in some cases, if the dog was already what I would call on borderline in its ability, yes, you could see the dog degrade and start to become like, why would I want to work when I can just do this all the time? Mm-hmm. But if you have the properly selected dog, that doesn't make a difference. And I know because I've lived it numerous times. In fact, my working dogs right now live in the house. My one spaniel is my firearms detection dog, sleeps in the bed with me sometimes. Not every time, but he does. So it's in my last dual purpose police dog, which is in a photo behind me over here. He was a dog that could live in the house with me, sleep in the room with me. He wouldn't sleep on the bed kind of thing, but he would just be in the room. And then when I moved on and my best friend picked him up as a dog, as his dog, that dog lived in his house with him. And it was a strong police dog. And that's, there's a lot of, in this industry, old wives' tales that get passed down generation to generation that, in this case, collaborating or living with your dog is a good thing, but it does have to have some type of limits to it, of course.
Right. So now when you're doing your training, are you training mostly for police and military? Like, who are the other people that would need dogs like this?
So yes, security, police, military are your biggest consumers of detection dogs. However, In my business now, I have a whole separate category because in the pet world, detection sports have skyrocketed as probably one of the fastest growing dog sports in the world, especially here in the United States. It's called either scent work or nose work, depending on what it is. And it's basically competitive detection. It's putting all kinds of breeds, whatever pet the person has, they go out and they search different environments. They'll do what they call interiors, which just means it's rooms or
it's inside of a building. Fun.
All for fun and all in a competitive way. But what's crazy is it's trained very similar to the professional side of things. And in most cases, some of these little pet dogs can run some circles around some of the professional side of things.
Oh, wow.
And when I've tried to do a competition where I put both sides together and to compete against each other, most of the professionals don't want to show up. And it's not because there's this, it's just, how would you, you know, and if you're a professional, you show up and you get beat by some lady with a Pomeranian and you got this big badass dog, there's going to be sometimes an ego hit. And with that said, you know, and I'm being kind of tongue in cheek with this, but in the competition side of things, it is what it is in a competition, and the real world is different, but it is something that I try to stress to professionals. Hey, you should watch some of the civilians and what they do, because you will pick up some important things, good and bad. You say, I would never do that, or that's a great idea.
This sounds like a perfect pitch for a network, because you know how they show like Ninja Warrior, whatever.
Yes.
And yeah. then they show the dog shows and they show all this stuff. That sounds pretty amazing. I feel like people would watch that. Like having
they did. They did a show.
Train. Oh, they did?
Yeah, it's called America's Top Dog. It did three seasons and it had multiple components of it. So basically they put up a cop versus civilians who did a very similar type of thing. And they had obstacle course, bite work, and then they had a detection component as well. And then it would each round would dwindle down to the end where you'd have basically the cop versus civilian in the final round. And in some cases, actually each year, the champion was a civilian.
Oh my God. Really?
Yeah.
Well, that sounds a lot actually.
Yeah.
So what happened to the show? It didn't have enough viewers or?
I guess it was on Animal Planet is where it was out of. And a friend of mine was the host for the first season of it. And then season two and three kind of got smushed together. They kind of did it back to back and then it just died off after that. It was actually filmed in LA.
Oh, wow. I'll have to go back and look at that. That sounds like something I would watch. This episode is brought to you by Uncomfy, sticking with moments that challenge us, a podcast. These are real stories from guests who dare to get uncomfortable in a moment that challenged their worldview. In the thick of intense emotions, they chose to stay curious and open rather than lash out or shy away and came out on the other side with stronger relationships, clearer beliefs, and increased confidence. And you can do it too. Part real life stories, part conflict coaching and self-improvement. So if you are burned out on social media and wish you could bring back the humanity into discussions online or in real life, look no further. Learn how to improve your communication, disagree more productively, and be a more inspired leader. In such a polarized world, learning how to stick with moments that challenge us without getting defensive or shutting down is a direct antidote for division. Hear how others are healing their communities, families, and neighborhoods, learning to talk about what matters to them, working to view others as human so we can build a better world together. Each episode models the mental health principles of MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, non-judging, patience, beginner's mind, trust, non-striving, acceptance, letting go. Recent stories include, he thought his comment was harmless, then he got written up, disrespected at the pool. She decided to confront the culprits when one word threatened a work partnership. She thought she was a good friend, then a birthday surprise went wrong. Uncomfy, sticking with moments that challenge us, a podcast. I finally discovered my sleep superhero with Dreamies. These gummies are like a cozy hug for my body and mind, getting me ready for a night of rejuvenation. Seriously, I wake up feeling like I can conquer the world. I've had a really hard time with my sleep cycles for years. I've tried prescription drugs. I've tried the melatonin and the things over the counter. Nothing really works for me. So the mix in Dreamies of melatonin and ashwagandha is a game changer for my racing thoughts. It's like hitting the off switch for my brain. And let's not forget magnesium. It's my go-to for easing those perky tensions after a long day of juggling work, family, and life. I love how Dreamies helps keep my melatonin levels in check. As I navigate this busy phase of life, it's comforting to know I have a little helper looking out for my well-being. Plus, I've noticed that catching enough Z's makes a big difference for my weight management. When I'm well-rested, I'm way more likely to choose that salad over the cookie, most of the time at least. Go to holisticgoddess.com and check out Dreamies. Get 15% off by using code UNDERSTOOD. Again, that's holisticgoddess.com with code UNDERSTOOD for 15% off. Okay, so back to my other question for a second, though. I know from discussing before we started, there are companies that they cannot, when they are doing security for big events, like you were talking about in Vegas, all these events, sometimes the event or the arena comes with security. But there are other times when there are people that are hired to come in and bring more security measures into an event or a conference or whatever it is. And they are not allowed to be getting dogs from the police department or the military. So they have to go to different companies that I guess do this for a living, that outsource their handler and the dog for security events, but it seems like it has backfired every time I've heard stories about this because the dogs aren't being used as much. They're all, you know, the handlers aren't trained in the ways that they should be. What are you seeing in that kind of world?
Well, unfortunately, the civilian security dog market and detection dog market is a very unregulated market. There is no national standard that has to be met. So basically what happens is there's probably, I'll just say maybe 10 to 12 organizations that conduct their own certifications. These certifications look pretty similar. Each organization creates their own little way of doing it, their own standard, let's say. Mm-hmm. And your bigger police ones, let's say your top five, are probably going to be police-oriented organizations. Some of those organizations will allow a civilian security company in to be tested and to be a part of the organization. Other ones do not. So when, let's say, a company, for whatever reason, could be geographically, they could be in an area that just doesn't have a major organization. So it becomes harder for them to either be judged or scrutinized, let's say, or meet a standard. Right. So then they just do their own thing, or they find the one that's closest to them. And I'll say this, a certification standard is what we refer to as the minimum standard, which means it's not very difficult at all. Hmm. It truly should be different. You know, there's a whole process being done right now in the United States to kind of deal with this issue. And that is to create what we call best practices. The people that are putting it together are a mixture of scientists, canine professionals, and legal experts. And they collaborate together. And it takes a long time because humans can never agree on anything completely. Right. So there's a lot of back and forth as they establish best practices. And within that, sometimes these best practices make organizations kind of nervous because it requires them to do things that they haven't done in forever or they've never done. Right. And not that it's hard, but change is hard. So you take programs like military or police who are very institutionalized programs. They've done it a certain way for a long time. And you tell them that, hey, maybe this isn't the best practice. Maybe this should be changed to this. And then that is causes some fear, causes some pullback because it requires change. So the civilian world, who is trying to basically, at the end of the day, the sad reality sometimes is some companies just care about making the money. They just want to get boots on the ground. Hey, look, there's a dog. There's a human handling a dog. And very minimal standards have been met. There are other companies that are exceptional. There's
and by
other
the way, like you said, sorry to interrupt you, but like you said earlier, that helps with the detection almost in the way automatically that if I'm walking in with drugs, I'm like, oh, I'm going to leave because they've got a dog. Whether or not that dog has been trained properly or not, I don't know. But that's the minimal detection, I think, that what obviously works, right? I mean, not detection.
Yeah, it's a deterrent. Yeah, it's just a deterrent factor. And for some companies, like bigger companies that hire these security teams, that's all they really cared about anyway. So, but the problem is it's a liability issue. The way I look at it is if, let's say something bad occurred, and when we look at it with hindsight and that 2020 vision, and they start nitpicking these details, did these canine teams meet a standard? And is the standard a recognized standard? Have they been tested with no notice? And all these different things that can occur. Usually bigger government contracts do have better oversight where they do basically unannounced checks. And that starts weeding out teams that may not be as good, where other private companies who reach out to another private company to augment or to do an event may not have these kind of things. So therefore, the risk of a quality team is increased because, just like you said, they can just go to the dog pound, grab a dog, put a fancy little harness on it, and that makes people feel comfortable because they see that. So yeah, it can run from one end of the spectrum all the way to the other end of the spectrum.
Right, exactly. What are some of the most challenging cases or scenarios you've encountered while training or working with these dogs?
I mean, for me, obviously the things I was asked to have the dogs be able to do with the Navy SEALs was definitely the most challenging in some cases.
Like, what are some of the things you had to do? Tell us.
So to be able to get a dog to go from a boat in the ocean, swim in maybe a kilometer, go through the surf passage, clear the beach. Once the beach is cleared, then the rest of the teams come up and then go maybe potentially another 8 kilometers, making sure that the route is as safe as possible. And then you get to your target where the real work has to happen. That is not an easy thing.
And they're doing it the whole time with the handler or their...
Oh, yes. Dog and handler and a lot of time with all the other operators traveling with them have to accomplish this. It could also mean riding in a helicopter, getting to a location, getting out and doing that stuff and making sure... And I would say the number one hardest thing was in that world was these dogs are, yes, they can bite, but their number one most effective thing was their nose to save the operators from stepping on an explosive or running across some other type of booby trap in the area. So, or an IED that's been set. So to have the dog maybe even see somebody running away, but if it smelled an explosive device, focus on the explosive device versus chasing the person that's running away. That was extremely difficult to try to train and maintain.
And I'm assuming you were able to do it.
Yeah. And what we learned, there was a lot of things that we learned when this was first, you know, we first went through this was, okay, this changed the type of dogs that we needed. We needed dogs because initially when a lot of military programs, especially special forces programs were first started in the early 2000s, they focused heavily on the bite side of things. They looked for these, we joked around, called them fur-coated razor blades. These dogs that would just, you know, if there was a bad person out there, that dog would mess that person up and engage, do that kind of stuff. But the problem was that type of dog was too aggressive for the type of work that they had to do. And the thing that saved soldiers' lives was the nose. So we needed to balance that back out. And then what, and that's kind of how I got deeper in the science was I ended up seeing a show on Nat Geo called Is Your Dog a Genius? And it was basically run by a guy named Dr. Brian Hare out of Duke University. And it was understanding the dog's mind. It was called canine cognition. And how does a dog think? Is a dog stronger in memory or is a dog stronger in inference? And when I watched the show, it highly exposed things that I saw in detection that were problematic. He was easily able to show that the dog, this particular dog, looks at a handler a lot, or this particular dog has high memory. And if you showed it something slightly different than what it had had before, or been reinforced for before, it may not indicate to it because it wasn't exactly the same. So a dog with high memory, though I didn't know this at the time of when I was training the dogs, that the high memory sometimes was the thing that I was dealing with as the problem as to why the dog wasn't indicating to, let's say, an explosive device that I didn't train it on. It was somebody else's explosive device or a homemade explosive device. But that dog who had hundreds of repetitions of being reinforced for this training aid that I had said, when the other one come in, that's virtually, let's just say 70% the same, goes, smells it, goes, nope, not what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
And that had more to do with memory than it did other things. And I didn't understand that. I would go through, oh, it's a training problem. And viewers and listeners would be like, oh, well, you can get through that and this, that, and the other. Yes, you can. And there's other things that it's about efficiency. And when I learned immediately that memory was a significant part of some of the things I dealt with, and then back earlier to your question about testing, once we got done with testing and we selected dogs that we liked, we then did dogs through cognitive testing. And at the end of the cognitive testing, if a dog scored where we wanted to score, those dogs were picked to work with us. So I could have loved a dog through our traditional, what we call subjective testing, things that I liked. But if it didn't score within the cognitive profile that we knew was good for the type of work, we would reject that dog.
Right.
And that came down. And the crazy part was the military spent a lot of money to train me and a few other guys on how to do these tests. And our proficiency got a whole lot better. We had dogs. We had a 30% increase in dogs that we selected that made it through the program. But what even crazier was, I want to say it was like, it was 40 something percent change in dogs that made it through the program. But then what we saw was a 30% reduction in training time. And that was directly attributed to the fact that I knew the dog better. I knew this dog was higher in inference or higher in memory. And because I knew that ahead of time, I could adjust the training a whole lot faster. I could say, okay, this dog's a memory dog. I need to show it a lot of versions of what this target looks like. So that way it understands it's not just this one, it's all of these. And if this thing is there, then tell me. And now I go around all over the United States teaching pet people cognition, teaching, you know, police cognition, because we've never looked at the dog's mind like we should have. We've always looked at things like motivation, drive, environmental, all the things I mentioned earlier. But we stopped there. And then when I share, we look at how the dog thinks, how the dog remembers, how the dog solves problems in its world, actually makes us better as trainers and more efficient and effective and a better relationship between the handler and dog.
Right. Just to jump back for one second, because I forgot to ask, what is a solution for people that do need that protective dog to do that they need to get these canines and they cannot get the military or the police dog? What are the safe options that you would suggest?
I mean, your best thing is seeking out companies with a strong work profile. So meaning that they've done lots of different types of events with very good reviews and success and collaboration with whoever they're working with. Mm. And even, you know, it's a pro and a con, because sometimes the companies that get so big that do have good history, also in certain regions, they're going to be really good. In other regions, they may not have enough handlers over there. So you may get I've seen some really good companies that just out of lack of, you know, manpower, reach out to teams that can be, are in an area, utilize them, but there's less oversight to those teams that are a little bit further out or may not get the same training as the busier regions do. So, it comes down to work performance and good performance history is your first thing I would go into when I'm selecting companies versus sometimes those smaller companies that may or may not be proven yet. I'm not saying they're not good, but they may not have the history or the proven history to show what they're capable of.
Right. But are there companies that are started by former military people?
Oh, yeah. I mean, almost all your, especially all your bigger ones, are either former feds, former military, former law enforcement. Those are your big ones. And then some of them are so big that it's a big bureaucratic system. They're used to government contracts. That's what they do. So your top parts of it haven't probably touched a leash in decades or more. Sure. So there's a disconnect sometimes that I get it. They're driven by gaining business. They pass that job down of handling and training down to the people below that are the trainers and the handlers and the regional trainers and so forth. You're supposed to keep up with making sure the quality is right. So to me, I'm drawn to are the ones who, when I go out and travel and work with, are the ones that are kind of in the middle. They're not so big that the top is disconnected from the bottom, and they're that sweet spot. They're like, it's not too big, not too small. They're just right. Their management staff has a really good understanding of the dogs. They're still part of either selection of dogs, training of dogs, because when they have to speak to a client, those are the ones who are going to speak to clients, are the ones who are in the positions of authority. Yeah. So if they've are still pretty good connected to the handling and training, they're going to have a better understanding than just yesing or saying, yeah, we want the contract. And it's more about schmoozing and take you out to great dinners. And let me show you how big our complex is and all these different things that kind of go into it. It's not just the dog world. It's in all those different security worlds as well. But the dog world will fall into that same kind of, you know, I would say system, because of the size of the company, because and what usually happens too, as sad as it is, those middle ground companies get bought out by their bigger company because that bigger company wants that other company's contracts. So right. They just get absorbed and it becomes incestual and things like that. And unfortunately there's no perfect system, but if I had to give advice, I would say the work history and finding a company that's big enough to support what you want. They can be no notice tested at any given time and perform well. Like, you could you hire somebody like me or people experience that show up that people don't know, and we test and we come through there with, you know, devices or something at the knowledge of the, let's say, the contract holder, whoever the event person is, and let them know, hey, here's what we found out. I stood right next to a dog team with an explosive item in my bag and not one anybody noticed. Or, hey, I was walking up and they caught me right away. The dog was all over it. So TSA does this too, but one of the things that we see is TSA will hire companies who do have to go through some pretty rigorous testing. So that's the good part of it. But most of the people going through there are fellow dog people, and they come through wearing things that they've been hanging around dogs in. So the dogs, imagine yourself, I'm sure you've seen it. You've been in your dog and the dog smells you more than somebody else. And you're like, oh, it's probably smelling my dog at home.
Yeah.
And there is some truth to that. Some dogs will be drawn to the dog smell, but they'll quickly dismiss it. Mm. So, but what we learned through research was we did some testing and we were looking at, to truly test a dog, we had to separate. We had to get volunteers who had nothing to do with the dog program at all, or any, didn't even get driven out by anybody from the program. So let's just say a canine supervisor gets told, hey, there's going to be a test going on. These people need to be driven to the site. Well, just riding in the car of the trainer or the manager those other dogs know that trainer or manager smell. So the minute you come walking through, they're drawn to it. Right. Or you're the one, or that trainer gives you a bag with an explosive training aid in it, but that's their training aid. That's their bag. And the dogs pick up, I just shared a thing in my social media yesterday called the detection dog cheat code. And what that is the dogs are designed to first look for something that doesn't belong. So in training, I'm putting out a training aid that doesn't belong in a training space. It, like this room I'm in right now has its own smell. But the minute I come in with a training aid, that training aid doesn't belong here. So the dog can pick that up pretty easily. Second thing is I'm going to hide it in some way. I'm going to put it in a drawer. I'm going to put it in some kind of barrier. So the dog goes, oh, okay, now it's concealed. That's another trigger that I know. Third thing is the person who put it out is somebody who I happen to know because I train all the time, whether I'm wearing rubber gloves, whether it's me, the handler or the trainer, the dog knows that part. And then the fourth part is it's training day. So we run all the dogs on the same training problem. So dog number two and the rest of them on smell another dog who they know in that area and at that location because their saliva is on that drawer now because that first dog found something.
Right.
So then the what I call the fifth one is where the handler starts reacting. The dog goes, we call it bracketing, snaps his head left or right. The handler goes, ooh, you're on something and reacts a certain way, or maybe reaches their hand toward their pocket where the reward's at. The dog goes, ooh, I know what's next. So all of those things are all before odor.
Right.
So what I want to do is reduce the cheat code as much as possible. So it means not running dogs over dogs in a search problem. Each dog gets its own search problem. A different person puts out the odor that's not the normal one. Or maybe I don't hide the odor in a certain way. Maybe I actually try to conceal the odor in a way that somebody who's trying to get away with it would do, not just stick it in an empty drawer. My joke was, how often has anybody found something in a filing cabinet? Because in training, we love filing cabinets. We love desk drawers. We love a car door seam. But those things aren't what we typically find in an operational environment.
Right, right. You said you got really science-based. You got into the science of it. How often is science changing, updating, and how do you incorporate that into your training programs? I mean, I know you're always out there training new people, but how does that get also implemented to all the other dogs and handlers out there?
That's a great question. And science is newer in detection. But the cool thing is we've learned more in the past 10 years than we have the previous 50 years when it came into detection. With that said, it's just like anything else you typically see on the media, which is you'll see a research study that says drinking a glass of coffee a day will help you live longer. But then tomorrow, another study comes out, says drinking coffee can kill you and can be carcinogenic.
Right.
So in the detection dog world, in the dog world itself, same things can happen. You'll get research that tells us some information and we'll jump on it and go, see, this validates my opinion. This validates my feeling. And certain trainers, including myself at times, were like, this is the way. See, it's backed up by science. What I can tell you now by after being involved for a lot of years is that science really is starting to help us understand the dog's olfaction capabilities better. We're also understanding how the dog thinks better, how to communicate to it better. We can't just sometimes go throw the baby out with the bathwater because some new research comes out and says something, but we can take something from the research world and say, ooh, okay, that's relevant. And for example, what I would say is there's a study done by a guy named Dr. Nathan Hall and a counterpart from the professional world, a guy named Paul Bunker, and they looked at the volume of odor. So if my training aids were ranging from, let's say, 2 grams to 45 grams, and I train on that frequently. But if I go up by 10 or down by 10, what they saw was the dogs dropped to 6.5% accuracy until reinforced at those new levels. Once they were shown that those new levels also received reinforcement, the dogs were good with it. But we could not assume that just because I train from 2 grams to 45 grams, or let's just say whatever it is to a pound, does it mean it would alert the same way to 100 pounds or 50 pounds? Which is why, like you were talking about earlier, the handler's ability to read their dog becomes critical because the dog may not show you all those really good things you saw in training. They may show you something totally different. And a good handler will go, hey, my dog didn't respond like it normally does, but I think there's something over here because of this predictable, repeatable thing that I know in my dog that tells me there's odor there. And that's where science has been helpful.
Right. It sounds like one of the biggest challenges that handlers or trainers are facing is being able to read the dog, correct? I mean, 100%. Is there something else also that's a big challenge that you guys run into?
Being able to make your training look like your reality. Because unfortunately, the training areas that we're given to go to are these old asbestos buildings that no one's in anymore. It's going to be destroyed or whatever. So they give you these old buildings to train in, or it's a car lot that's cars that are going to be demolished that are in a junkyard, or it's the county or city fleet vehicles that never have anybody in them versus the typical things that you're going to deal with. The real world's going to have a room with all kinds of things in it because people are in it, not rooms that have had nobody in them for years or months. So the biggest thing that besides the handler's ability to read the dog is to make your training look like your reality. That's like, I would put that as a close number two into reading the dog, is to make sure that my training overlaps with reality really well, that my dog can't really tell the difference anymore between training and reality. That's a big thing.
Right. I want to go back just for 1 second to the importance of scent detection. Can you first explain to people listening how good of a sense smell is to dogs compared to what we think our smell is?
Yeah. So Auburn University did some good studies on this, and they just, I would say probably a couple of years ago, had a dog alert to something down to the quadrillionth.
Oh.
So each dog's nose is unique like us. There's some dogs who I joke around have the Michael Jordan nose. They just have an amazing ability with their nose. Where another dog could be a sibling. Like my joke is, how many know of Michael Jordan's brother? People are like, they may not know, right? Obviously, they don't know Frank Jordan. Yeah, oh. He's got two brothers. So
guys.
Yeah, so, but there's genetics there, they're the same. So just because genetics are the same doesn't mean that capability is the same. So in this case, dogs' olfaction capabilities are obviously way better than humans by a lot.
Right.
There is no precise number per se, because even within the dog spectrum, they have abilities that are stronger than other ones. So for example, a bloodhound in most cases have really exceptional abilities for olfaction as opposed to a sight hound, like a greyhound or whatever. Mm-hmm. But within the breeds that we work with, there is still differences. So the average is dogs get down to the parts per billion, parts per trillion as an average, but there are the dogs that get down to the parts per quadrillion, which means there's a phenomenon that happens in training a lot. We call it not at source, which means the dog's alerting to an odor, but they're not as close as they can get. And in some cases, we blamed it on the training or any number of other factors. What we didn't sometimes take in consideration was this dog is so sensitive, it's picking it up this far away, and it's already strong to that dog, where the other dog whose nose was actually weaker got closer to where you actually hid the substance. And there's a big misconception that the dogs always find something. Dogs are trained to the odor of a substance, not necessarily the substance. So this is why a dog can indicate and tell you something's there, even though the substance is no longer there, because residual or lingering odor still exists.
Wait, I love this concept. So I love all these crime shows, and you always see these search and rescues and how they give a piece of clothing of a missing child. And then the dog is able to head a certain way, not always find the child, but head a certain way. Explain that whole scenario. I mean, you kind of did, but it's so fascinating. And you almost think that it's sci-fi, that it's not real, but it is.
Yep. We joke around sometimes. It's not magic, you know, but it feels magical because we can't explain it, right?
Yeah.
And the dogs can't talk to us to tell us what they're doing or how they're processing this information. Mm-hmm. So again, there's a lot of factors that are all coming together. It's the training, it's the dog's ability, it's the handler's ability to understand and read their dog. Those three core things are all happening together, but each team has different levels of how this all works. So if I have a dog who's got a really sensitive nose, and my handler may or may not be able to interpret that as good, or they dismiss it thinking the dog is being inaccurate when the dog is actually being highly accurate, so accurate it's like, I can't tell the difference anymore. Then you got a handler who can read that really well and goes, yeah, my dog is on something and I need to let it work it out, or I will find ways to help the dog problem solve whatever our search area is. So in your example, if I can read my dog really well, and my dog is picking up something and I trust what I'm reading. I follow it. And lo and behold, maybe we find an article of clothing or maybe we find an item that was discarded. And then that confirms, hey, we're on the right track. Where somebody else may see the dog doing something and go, oh, it's not, I'm not seeing anything here. And they dismiss the behavior that they're watching and go a different direction. Or they get influenced by somebody else who's not a dog handler and goes, oh, but I saw, why are you going that way? I saw them go that way.
Right.
And then that becomes what dictates, is a whole study I did called human bias. It was the effect of handler bias on dogs. And what we looked at was how much did the handler ability to interpret the dog or the handler's biases affect the outcome of the search? Because the dogs are honest. People refer to dogs as cheaters, liars, et cetera. They're not. They're just following the information that you give them. And if you're giving them, let's say, not accurate information, or you're giving them the cheat code too much with it not being about odor, then you're going to have a dog who's less accurate, but then you blame it on, well, that dog's is a, the joke around is that dog's a cheating bastard. He's just trying to get his toy from you. That's all they're trying to do is they're going to offer a sit. Well, they do that because they've learned things from you that tell them that's what you really want versus letting the dog get good at figuring it out. So what we want to do is control the environment and not the dog. Allow the dog to make decisions. In the beginning, I know the outcomes. I know which way is the correct way. I know which way is the incorrect way. And let the dog get reinforcement for its self-discovery. Those are better ways than me forcing it or me directing it too much. Because later on, I don't know the information. If I don't know the information, what good am I as a source of information if I put myself into play too much?
Right. I'm curious, can dogs influence other dogs? Meaning if you're showing them a piece of clothing and they're smelling it and you give it to five different dogs, will they all go the same direction following each other, or they might go their different paths? Or do you never put more than one dog on one scent?
So in training, what happens, and this isn't for everybody, but some cases you will see that occur. I would say that's less these days than it used to be. In most cases, when it comes to, let's say, what they call tracking or trailing, those dogs will have their own track or their own trail. They won't typically put another dog over another dog on a trail. Does it happen? Sure, it can happen. Sometimes it does in training, but like I say, I would call that very rare.
So they're doing one dog usually.
Yeah, they're doing one dog per track. Now, will they use the same track layer with, you know, have the same person lay multiple tracks and different dogs do each track? Yeah, that could happen more frequently. So, but the problem with that starts happening is the dogs will get really good at tracking the track layers. And then when reality happens, it's a lost person with either autism or Alzheimer's or things like that. The dog has never experienced that before, and they're not as accurate as they are in training. Right. So that's where reading your dog becomes really good, and why in that world, having a plethora of different people to be track layers for you is so important. So the dog gets good at that. Again, giving example that Dr. Nathan Hall did, he said, here's a good way to make sure that you know your dog is actually following what you think it is. So you get six people, they all hold an item, and then they put that item into a glass jar. That glass jar is labeled one through six. And those jars are left there. The people who touched those articles all go off in different directions. Each one has their own track. Then the dog handler comes up with its trainer and they roll the dice. So the dice rolls and let's say it lands on five. So they grab jar number five, let the dog smell what's in jar number five, and then they go out and see, can they find where number five's trail went?
Oh, cool.
That's how you start seeing, does the dog really know this system or not?
Wow.
And that is a true, honest way to test your capability versus going, I know, again, this is a later phase of training. Mm-hmm. This is not how you start, but this is how you validate what you've done. And is the dog really following what you think it is?
Right. Oh my God. That's fascinating. How do you address the well-being or stress levels of the dog when they're in training and actually when they're on an operation or a mission, whatever you call it?
Yeah. So like you said, this comes down to knowing your dog, knowing sometimes it could be a subtle sign. It could be how their ears are laying on their head. It could be how their tail is wagging. Being perceptive about your dog's behaviors and nuances of behavior will tell you, is your dog beginning to go into stress or is your dog comfortable about things? Mm. And there's lots of different, there's all like us, there's all kinds of stress. There's stress because I'm excited. There's stress because I am going through something that's, you know, basically negative feeling. And can, let's say, just a dog coming into an environment, there's some unique things I've watched in conservation detection, where they're searching in environments that you could have panthers, jaguars, lions, and so forth in the environment. And a dog goes in there and goes, ooh, I smell a predator and I don't want to be prey. And without even knowing it, you'll see a dog act a certain way. And if a handler dismisses that and kind of keeps pursuing, they could find themselves in a bad position. And what we deal with in most times, police, military, et cetera, going into certain environments, dogs are going to exhibit certain signs. Most times it's going to be high levels of motivation or drive. The dog's a little bit too wound up. So therefore they may not perform as good because they're so excited. It's like taking your kid going to Disney World, but in the parking lot, what does a kid want to do? It wants to run as fast as it can to get to the gates, to get in there. But you're like, no, calm down, slow down. You know, you can't expect the kid, or say, before we go in, you must solve this math problem. Now here's your book. Here, the kid's gonna be like, I can't concentrate. All I see is Mickey Mouse over there. I want to go that way. So same thing happens with working dogs. We want to make sure that we teach them how to regulate some of these emotions and motivations so that way they can perform better. But it falls back to that handler to read those subtle nuances in their expressive behaviors, their body language, to tell us that, are they in the right mind state to do what we're supposed to do? Or maybe we need to take a time out for a second and reevaluate where we're at.
But for the most part, do these dogs just love doing this? I mean, I see pictures of dogs like jumping out of airplanes and it almost makes me want to cry because I'm like, these poor animals, they've got to hate that.
So again, to your point, it comes down to, so first, the dogs have been selected to kind of go through things that we would view as stressful. But for them, they say the outcome of this is actually a lot of fun. So jumping out of the airplane is, you know, for some dogs, tells them it's predictive to fun. So initially it could be stressful, but then they realize when they land, they're going to go do something they enjoy. So some dogs have no problem doing it whatsoever. Other dogs, to your point, are going to be like, oh, this sucks. This isn't very fun. Like we did rappelling exercises and it wasn't that hard. We just have a tower and the dogs are hooked to the handler. And when you first step off the tower, there's nothing there for the dog's feet. So dogs are like clinging on, like they want something underneath them. Oh. And so our first exercise is only a few feet off the ground. So they just step off and we're right in the ground and then they get to go play. They get to go maybe bite the decoy or do something fun. Mm-hmm. And then you start showing them that this exercise predicts something really enjoyable. Then they're like, heck yeah, throw me in. Let's go. I want to go do this. But if you do see a dog who doesn't adapt that way, then you say, this is a limitation that this dog shouldn't be doing. And we're not going to force it because forcing it is going to have an outcome that we don't want. So again, this is important to, we have to adjust to the dogs in front of us. So that way we give them the best experience. So therefore they're the best at what they do.
Right. Right. What trends or innovations do you believe will define the next decade of canine training?
It's the merger of technology and dogs together. So what's really starting to happen is we even have now these boxes that will have multiple, up to I think 12 different odors in each box. The computer picks out which box is going to be what we call the hot box, the box that has the target odor in it. These boxes can also regulate how much odor is coming out, so how strong or how little and how mixed it is. It also creates what we call a blank run. So unknown to the handler, the dog will search each box and there's no odor present. The dog, this is probably one of the most critical things that also doesn't get done, is showing the dog that they don't always have to find something, that zero is a very common thing. So, and then like we were talking about earlier, protection of site resources or a concert or a venue, most times you're going to be searching for hours and not find anything other than something that you may intentionally put out for the dog to be motivated. But what we need to show the dog early on is that, hey, there's nothing there. So these computerized systems are better at showing the dog that system because the computer doesn't have an emotion. The computer doesn't go, oh, you know, if he doesn't find anything, it's going to be depressed because it wants his toy. Or you can say, or like the computer does, if a dog does the correct response, meaning no response, it gets reinforcement. Right. So it gets reinforcement for finding odor and it gets reinforcement for the correct answer of no odor present. But what's even crazier is, as this technology, and it basically we're here now, where the dog can basically wear a harness and the AI reads the dog's physiological responses to what it does when it comes into odor. So what we're going to have probably within 5 to 10 years or less is a dog that indicates, and on the handler's watch or phone will tell you the dog is responding to a target odor based on all these algorithms that the system is reading through the harness. So the heart rate change, the breathing change, all these things.
Do you think that in the future, 5, 10 years from now, we will see that canines are the norm, like they are becoming more established and this is how police departments, military, whatever it is, are, they must have a canine person? Or do you think it'll diminish because AI can take over that in some way, shape or form?
I think for the most part, we're probably going to stay fairly status quo. But okay, what we'll see is more trust in this, in the dogs and the handlers, because AI is going to be kind of that equalizer. It's not going to be up to the handler's interpretation only. It's going to be quantified now by something that's kind of overseeing it and telling us things that we couldn't see ourselves or that maybe we just missed ourselves. You know, a really good handler will probably be able to do pretty close to what the AI is confirming. But unfortunately, what happens is, I'll give an example. The average police these days, because of either defunding or et cetera, the average police dog handler school is 6 weeks or less. So I'm going to take a person in some cases who's maybe never had a dog in their life. They are a police officer. They go to school, they get their dog, they go through 6 weeks of training only, and then they certify, which meant they found a, they did a minimum standard. And then now they're on the road and we expect them to be at a high quality because the administrator, the chief of police or the sheriff says, well, they got a piece of paper right here. They were certified by Joe Blow, who said this is what they're good at. I don't understand. The legal system challenges that and says, okay, how do we know you're good? What record keeping, what experience do you have? How do you know the dog is telling you something? So what we're going to see with technology coming into that, it's going to, my joke is, I'm going to tell handlers a few years from now, do you know how hard I had it? I had to freaking guess if my dog was on odor or not. I didn't have my phone confirm for me that there was something there or not. So it's going to stay probably about the same, but it'll be much more accurate, which then in some cases may have places who weren't using dogs may add a dog or two to the system. Our biggest thing is still supply and demand. Having enough dog teams to do some of the jobs that we ask them to do, or enough quality dogs to go do this, that's still, and the cost of this, the cost keeps going up. I mean, we've had a change where our USDA now says dogs coming into the United States from Europe must have, we call a 6-month titer test, meaning the dog must show it doesn't have rabies for 6 months before it come over. And that is going to incur higher costs. So it's going to change how, or how much some agencies can pay for dogs. And that may shift it down a little bit too.
Would you say in your field that you think that something that's misunderstood about this industry and canines in general is the credibility of them or what they can really do, and people just don't believe in it yet? So it's kind of like pushed to the side?
Yeah, there's a lot of misunderstanding about canine capability. And some of it is self-inflicted, because when some of these handlers get on a stand and they're asked questions, they haven't been, again, back to educating the handler side of the equation. We don't do enough to educate the handlers like we should. So that way they can answer some questions better than they do now, or they're able to articulate through a report what occurred. So making sure that we can actually explain what's happening. And then the other part of that is we, again, society, whether it be judge, jury, or just the public in general, have to know dogs aren't perfect. And we already know the handlers aren't perfect. We're not looking for certainty. We're looking for probability. And the dogs increase our probability for deterrence or finding something illegal or something that's dangerous that we don't want to enter an area.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay. Where could people find more out about you? I know you do some seminars. It's not just for military and police, right?
Correct.
A civilian can get involved. Tell us how people can find you.
Yeah. So my website is just fordk9.com, FORDK9.com. They can go to my website. My social media handles are Cameron Ford K9. So if it's Instagram, it'll say Cameron Ford K9, Facebook, Cameron Ford K9, or just on Facebook and all the Instagram things are on YouTube. We probably have a few hundred videos on YouTube. You just put at Ford Canine, you'll find our channel there. And of course, the podcast, Canines Talking Sense, where I do, like you, I interview what I call subject matter experts from the science world or from experience, and they share their stories and they share information that we do on that podcast. But that's how you find me. And yes, you're correct. I do police, military, security, civilians. I want to say right now we're probably 50-50 between working with civilian entities, people just do it for fun, for sport, search and rescue, security companies, to the professional side of things. It's across the board.
Amazing. If you're ever in Palm Beach, you need to come talk to me about my dogs, because when my trainer is here, they act like police dogs. And then when I am here, they act like they don't know their name. So
I joke around about that, because I say, so back in the day when I used to do obedience stuff, this is back when I lived in Orlando for years, I would joke around. I would say, yes, you can bring your dog to me for training, but I'm the rehab clinic. Your house is the bar. Right. You're leaving your bottle of Jack Daniels on the counter. You have glasses of this. And then when they come to my place is the Betty Ford Clinic. We don't have that stuff out anywhere. So that's why I joke around. I tell people, like, you have to turn your place into a rehab clinic for a little while, so that way your dog behaves like it does when it's with me.
Right. And we have to be trained by you totally as well. Cause I'm, you know, absolutely, I'm always the one like, oh, coddling the dog, cause I don't
want to raise love the dog. So why don't we want to coddle them? Right. Yes, if that's right. Why we love them. We love what they give to us. And it's not easy sometimes to be that rule enforcer, like, no, don't jump right now, or no, don't do this. Cause we see them, or they give us those cute little eyes and we're like, it's okay. Yeah. You can jump in the bed. Okay. Come up here, or come on the sofa with me and let's hang out. Yeah. So believe me, I'm just as guilty as a dog trainer myself. My dogs are on the sofa sometimes. I am not always the best example for house manners, because, you know, my dogs have jobs. So I also make sure that the living and the life when we're not working is a lot of fun. So, hey, I'm the first to admit I'm the same, but I'm always glad to help whenever I can.
Yeah. Cameron, you're such a delight. It was so great getting to know more about this industry. I wish you the best of luck. People, please tune into his podcast, Canines Talking Sense. And hopefully we'll have you back on in the future to talk more about this. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.